Welcome back, everyone. I have the pleasure to speak with Dr. Hagioff today. And Dr. Hagioff has a bunch of experience in the health and scientific policy area, a lot of experience in medical research, and is just a great, smart guy to talk with. So why don't you introduce yourself, Dr. Hagioff? How did you get into medicine? What are your current research interests? And what would you generally like to share with us?
Thank you. Thank you so much, David. You're very, very kind. So yeah, my background is that I'm a physician, an epidemiologist, and a health economist by training. I've done all sorts of things over my career. I've been chief medical officer of about a dozen organizations, ranging from little startups around someone's kitchen table up to multi-billion dollar multinationals and sort of every shade in between. Currently, I'm particularly interested in these compounds called PFAS, per and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, that are environmental pollutants that are potentially a bit worrying. They hang around a long time in the body, and we're learning more and more about them at the moment. As to how did I get into medicine, do you know what? Mostly, it was because I wanted to stay on at school and go to college, and my folks didn't want me to, if I'm really, really honest. So about 12 years old, I put together this ruse, and I said, I'm going to be a doctor, because I just knew. I just knew that the family would not get away with making me leave school and go out and get a job like my dad had. And so I went to medical school for completely the wrong reasons, under completely false pretenses, but I found my place. I found my bliss. And it's a career that I can't say I've enjoyed every day of it, because in any work you have a bad day now and then. But I don't regret being a doctor for a moment. I think it's the most amazing career.
Wow. What would you say was one of the most impactful stories, maybe patient encounters or maybe some kind of policy decision relative to health that you had the chance to be on a board meeting about, or sort of help in the making of, that really impacted you and that's still memorable to this day?
Oh, that's difficult, putting me on the spot. I suppose there's a couple of things that jump straight to mind. We did some work. There was a team set up in the UK about 20 years ago now called the Infant Mortality National Support Team. And what it would do is it would go to parts of the country where more children were dying than in other parts of the country in the first year of life, and just work with them to see what their policies were, how things were managed, et cetera, and also share knowledge from other parts of the country. And so we went around maybe 20% of England where we were working, and worked with all sorts of things. Like, so the children of sort of teenage parents are much more likely to die in the first year of life. And one of the reasons for that is that they don't necessarily understand nutrition, the parents. So we got firefighters to teach cooking to teenage dads. And of course, every teenage dad wants to talk to firefighters because they're heroes. Well, not everyone, but a lot do. And firefighters are really interested in their fitness and health. And they spend a lot of time cooking for each other. So they understand nutrition. And so things like that, and around how babies were sleeping, where they were sleeping, that was the whole project. And we had an independent evaluation at the end of it. And in the year that we were working, we could be directly assumed to have prevented 900 infant deaths. That's 900 babies in the first year of life who would otherwise have died, who potentially have got a whole lifetime. So that's something I'm really proud of. And more recently, like about 10 years back, maybe a bit less, the suspected cancer work that we did here in the UK. And again, looking at when people should be investigated and how for cancer. So not treating, just getting people through the door and through the right door to get the right treatment. And that was estimated to have prevented 5,000 premature deaths a year, which is massive stuff. And I guess those are the things that stick in my mind at the moment, because you'd have to work pretty damn hard to save 5,000 lives a year by seeing patients directly. And people get really excited by the sort of sexy side of medicine, the, you know, doing emergency operations and the stuff we see on TV. But actually, some of the policy and prevention work that we can do, the public health work, can have a much, much greater impact. And so I like to use those just to say, yeah, I know it doesn't sound sexy at first, but this stuff is also really, really important.
Wow, that's very commendable. I mean, that's a really big impact you had and then your team. And I'm sure that inspired many of the projects that you're currently working on or have continued to work on. You mentioned earlier that you're currently working on a project on polyfluoroalkyl substances, and that's a more recent project you've started on. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on that and kind of what it's about, what it could entail, and why'd you get started in it?
Yeah, so that's interesting. That's a relatively new piece of work. I'm new to the field. And I've been brought in by the government of a small country to chair an independent scientific panel on these substances. And I've got a couple of the sort of foremost experts in the world on these PFAS molecules, and what their impact is on the environment and on people, and what you can do to make any to address any problems that might arise. And I've gone in as the sort of, I don't know how to describe it, as the idiot. I've been brought in. I actually said from day one, I don't want to be an expert on this, at least not now. Maybe at the end, but not now. I want to be a non-expert so I can ask daft questions. The questions that experts don't think to ask each other. So that's my role. I've only been doing this since April, so it's all pretty new. We're just coming towards the end of producing our first report, which is on therapeutic phlebotomy, which is taking blood. You know, when you go and donate blood, well, some people do that to treat illness. So there are illnesses where you've got too many blood cells, where you've got too much iron in your body, and that sort of thing. Where they would go and, in effect, do the same as what you do when you were giving blood to treat their illness. Well, we're just about to produce a report on whether that is useful in people who've been exposed to PFAS. The reason it's important, why PFAS are important, is they stay in your body a heck of a long time. You know, the reports vary from 8 or 9 years half-life, so going from where it was to half of where it was, to down to maybe 2 years half-life. And that's a long time, particularly if these are compounds that might cause some problems in the body. And we'll be looking in detail in our next report at what problems there may or may not be and how much evidence there is. And then our report after that will be about all the possible treatments that we could engage in to treat people who've been exposed if it's needed, and how we would test populations. And then our final report is, and how to clean up the environment if we need to. What actually works to get this out of the world? And it's interesting because, how can I put this? We do a lot of things with chemicals. We do a lot of things with new technologies and ideas. And it's always much, much more difficult to get them back into the box than to get them out of the box in the first place. And this is a whole how do we need to? And if we do, how do we get it back in the box? And it's kind of leading the conversation. So it's a very exciting project. As you can tell by the tone in my voice.
Yeah, I mean, once again, that's a very commendable project and feat that you are currently engaged in. How you mentioned it's very easy to contain something once it's still in sort of the medical Pandora's box kind of thing. How did this happen where these sort of PFAS substances, they escaped and, you know, became ever so present in maybe our environment and the different maybe containers we use for food, et cetera?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the first cases were in the US. So originally, I think it was DuPont's first. And in order to make non-stick pans, pots and pans, they needed to use these compounds. It made it a lot easier to produce those nonstick pans. And so the original concerns about exposure were amongst the workers in those facilities and maybe people who lived quite close to them. Then there was some concern around food packaging. So if you go back 20, 25 years, a lot of food packaging, you know, like butter wrappers and that sort of thing, actually had traces of these chemicals in them because they were easier to use in the manufacture of the wrappers. So that was responsible for some of the background. More recently, a lot of the problems relate to fire retardant foams. Some of those are manufactured by 3M, and there have been a lot of work around with 3M around remediating that. So these foams are really, really good at putting fires out, which is a good thing. The problem is that if there are a lot of fires near where you live, or if you work putting out fires, for example, then you get exposed again and again and again to these compounds. And potentially they find their way into the water supply, et cetera. So that's where most of the modern exposures are now. I suppose in the middle there was a bit, I've forgotten what it's called now, the stuff people used to spray on their shoes and on their furniture to stop it staining, Scotchgard. So there was a period of time when Scotchgard contained PFAS as well. And some of the really early cases were around people who were very, very enthusiastic around spraying their carpets and their furniture. And so were exposed over a long period of time. But all of this has been a learning curve. And where we are now is these compounds aren't used anymore. The potential for risk has been understood and has been accepted, even though the actual magnitude and nature of the risk is less clear. The potential for risk has been agreed, and they're not really used anymore. But now what we need to do is try and get that genie back into the bottle and firstly understand really, is it a real risk or is it an imaginary risk? How big is it if it's real? And the thing is, even imaginary risks harm people. I should have mentioned that. Just because it turns out that a chemical is safe doesn't mean that people aren't afraid of it. And being afraid of things is not good for people's health. It's not good for their life expectancy, and it's not good for their well-being. So getting clear answers, I think, are really important, even if the clear answer is it's not harmful, which I'm not sure that's what it will be. I don't want to second guess, a several-year project at this stage. How to manage it? What do we do to help people sort of get back as far as they can away from that exposure? What can we do to clean up the environment so that people aren't being exposed again? And I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation. But it's not just PFAS. There are so many other compounds that we have sort of brought into existence, that we've put out there, and that we've either withdrawn or we may well be doing in the future. I was reading a paper yesterday about paraquat. Paraquat was a weed killer, I think, that's banned in the whole world. I think Iran still uses it. I don't think anywhere else in the world uses it. Poisoned loads and loads of people because the chemistry of it was not fully understood before it was out there in the world. And there are hundreds and hundreds of other cases like that. What's important is that we take a precautionary approach when we bring in new technologies so that we don't do harm. I guess what I'm excited about is that I'm trying to minimize potential harm that might be done. The way I see it, I'm going to minimize harm regardless through this work, or we are, because if nothing else, it will put people's minds at rest. And that's a really important thing to do. And it's at the head of the pack. There have been like four or five, maybe a couple more investigations around the world. And so suddenly this small country potentially is close to the forefront of how to develop policy around these compounds. Very exciting.
Well, Dr. Hadjioff, I'm sure we're all glad that you're one of the people spearheading this sort of project. We'd love to have you back on, talk more about it once you guys, discover more things and hopefully find ways to sort of remediate that problem. When you were talking about it's really important to figure out how to manage this sort of outbreak of chemicals, that we shouldn't release these into the environment without knowing at least a significant portion of their potential risk factors to people, to the environment, etc. It sounds familiar to a lot of the sort of supplements released in the US. It seems kind of sort of unregulated, but I'm sure the UK is a little bit more stringent on these things. I'm interested to hear your perspective on maybe the supplement and food regulation industry in the UK relative to the US and how we can apply a lot of these same principles when coming out with new supplements, the same way we would approach different medications, same way we would approach the release of certain chemicals and the development of products and so on.
Yeah, look, I think supplements are a really, really interesting industry. And there really are some fascinating substances in there that really could be a great benefit to people. I think part of the problem is if it's not adequately regulated, people don't know what they're getting, and they don't even know if they're getting what they think they're getting, if that makes sense. I remember one study, I forget when it was, this is maybe 5 or 10 years back, looked at vitamin supplements, vitamin D3, which is a common supplement that people will go and buy in the pharmacy, particularly people who don't spend a lot of time outdoors or people with darker skin who are at risk of having a low vitamin D3 because it's the sunlight vitamin, if that makes sense. And this study looked at vitamin D3 and it found that with some manufacturers, even within the same carton or container of vitamin capsules, there was a 10 or 20 fold variation from one capsule to the next in the amount of vitamin D3 that was in there. And some compounds, manufacturers were producing capsules that had hardly any in there at all. That's clearly a problem. It's a problem because you may not be getting what you're relying on. Now, thankfully, vitamin D3 is something really safe, so it doesn't matter if you're getting a bit more. But other things are potentially more problematic. So if you're getting more than it says on the container, that's also potentially a problem. Or if it's something where you need a steady dose over time and it's fluctuating up and down and up and down, that's also a problem. So one of the reasons why the supplement industry needs to be regulated, I guess another piece is around what else is in there. People might say, well, it's just a plant. How can this plant do me any harm? It's been around, thousands of years. But what happens if this plant is grown in polluted water? What happens if in the processing of this plant, other compounds are introduced into the liquid or into the capsules that are finally produced? That's clearly not what people want. But without regulation, you can't control for that. And I think these are the sorts of reasons why in Europe and in general in the UK, we've had quite strong controls around supplements for quite a long time. There are even restrictions on what you can claim about what a supplement might do. And again, there's good reasons for that, because if I say this supplement cures diabetes, there is a risk that one guy is going to see this and stop taking his insulin and do himself serious harm because he's got this supplement. Claims that are not in line with proven evidence are really, really dangerous. And so we have quite strong restrictions on what claims that can be made around supplements. And that's probably a good thing. I guess the final piece is there are some supplements that are available in North America that are not available in Europe. Mm-hmm. The one that springs to mind immediately for me is melatonin.
Common one.
Melatonin is only available in a very, very pure form on prescription for people with certain very, very specific conditions. You can't just go into your sort of local equivalent, your local pharmacy, and buy melatonin, even though it almost certainly is very safe and it's very, very widely used in North America and other parts of the world. And that's because it hasn't been through the licensing process for supplements anywhere in Europe. And no manufacturer thinks it's worth their while. They don't think it's cost effective to take it through that process, I guess, which is why it hasn't, which is why some of us who travel to the US quite a lot might bring ourselves some back every now and then to help with those those jet lag days.
Right. And the way you talk about that, that's very interesting. I know melatonin and getting good sleep, it's very easy to take a supplement and maybe the placebo kicks in. So you think it'll help you get a good night's rest and maybe it will. But yeah, it's interesting to hear how the UK medical system and the supplement industry is a little bit more stringent than what we might find in the US. That sounds very familiar to how a lot of people or a lot of advertisements talk about artificial sweeteners and how that may be better than, for example, consuming sugary drinks of your typical Diet Coke versus a regular Coke or Pepsi. I know you're very interested and have done a lot of research with the gut microbiome and many of the neurotransmitters there and how, for example, different artificial sweeteners can cause glucose spikes or the literature surround that. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on.
I mean, I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm really interested in it. I think, you know, it's one of the most, probably the most important organ in our body that we know almost nothing about, the gut microbiome. And increasingly, more and more and more is coming to our attention about its importance in a whole range of conditions from autism to immune diseases like rheumatoid to depression. That's the sort of Yukon gold mining territory for the future of medical research in a way. In my opinion, the artificial sweeteners story is a really, really interesting one, and it's interesting because we've kind of got it wrong again and again and again. You know, the first artificial sweetener was a compound called cyclamate. And that was around in the market. This is back in the 40s and 50s, I think, even before my time. But that was around, and it was quite a long time of it being used before it was realized that it actually caused cancer. Likewise, saccharin sodium was another artificial sweetener that was very, very widely used that became known to be associated with some adverse health effects. And so it was kind of replaced with, I've forgotten the name of it, acesulfame, which is NutraSweet. And then that sort of got shifted and we moved towards sucralose and towards other artificial sweeteners. One of the things that's really interesting is some of the recent studies. Now, people use artificial sweeteners because they want to reduce the calorie load in their body. Certainly that's a big part of it because we've got this mechanistic understanding that the human body is like a car. If you drive more than if you put in more gasoline than you drive, this is not a great analogy, but it starts spilling out all over the place and ends up causing problems. Actually, obesity is much more complicated than calories in and calories out. And the microbiome is really, really important in that. So, but people want to reduce their calories, so they take these artificial sweeteners. And then you find some really interesting studies that show that actually, if you have artificial sweeteners alongside a meal that contains starches, you actually break down more of the starches and end up absorbing more sugar as a whole than you would if you had sugar-containing beverages alongside those starches. So then you sort of end up in a position, well, maybe they're okay if you're not consuming carbohydrate at all, but we don't know that. You know, that's just a guess. Now, someone needs to do that research now as well and see what the effects are on glucose spikes and on the microbiome of them in the absence of carbohydrate. But the takeaway is, you know, if you're having a bag of chips, fries, you probably want to have a sugar-containing beverage with them and not an artificial sweetener-containing beverage if you want to keep your blood sugar low and your calorie intake lower, strangely.
Right.
Your effective calorie intake. And there will be thousands of other cases like this where we make assumptions about a particular thing. And then eventually research shows us that the situation is completely different.
That's very interesting. I did not know that artificial sweeteners can have such an impact on blood glucose levels relative to your typical refined sugars. But that is interesting. So whoever wants to go in and pioneer that kind of research, feel free. The field is there.
But it's not my space, but I would love to see more of that work going, because it's absolutely fascinating. That's the sort of stuff I read for fun, because I think it's genius.
And yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. And you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the fact that there seems to be this one conception that diet Coke and diet beverages, etc., are much better for you relative to sugar, but it turns out that might not be the reality. It's similar to how we see many different stories in the media about, for example, maybe something like how not eating vegetables and going on the carnivore diet is the best, or going on some other fad diet, or maybe the keto or something else, or even other sort of like conspiracies about different medical technologies, like potentially vaccines and how that could be maybe implicated in certain diseases, or maybe different ways on how we've dealt with the pandemic, et cetera. What's kind of your take on what we can do maybe in the news media, or kind of understand as culture, society, that conspiracy theories and sort of these different avenues of thought aren't so prone, and we're able to maybe understand better the instead of going off and thinking, oh, maybe this is the reality, how do we kind of accept the scientific details that come out instead of coming up with a whole bunch of different theories that end up proving not to be true? Sort of field of misconception.
That is a massive question. And you're absolutely right. You know, there is, you know, if you look across the piece, there is an enormous amount of misunderstanding. And there's also a little bit of fraud in there and some grandstanding as well that all contribute to people not being properly informed. I mean, this whole story about MMR vaccine and autism, that was a guy who committed fraud. The guy who claimed that, he used to be a doctor. He used to work about 2 miles from where I'm sitting right now. He committed fraud. And yet that's had a massive effect on people going forward, and children have died of measles because of the fraud he committed. So yeah, that's at one extreme sort of level. I guess the next piece is the people who are just grandstanding. They're claiming to be experts when they're not. And we saw a lot of this through the coronavirus pandemic. We saw a lot of people who claimed to be experts on infectious disease epidemiology, and who made claims that might or might not be correct. And if you actually looked into their background, it's something they knew nothing about. Now, there was one guy who was repeatedly on the TV on this side of the water, whose job title was epidemiologist. But actually, if you drilled into and he, if you drilled into his background, he was a genetic epidemiologist. He knew nothing about infectious diseases. His research was all around how genes spread in different populations. You know, the association of disease causing genes with ethnicities and things like that. That's not anything to do with infectious disease. But bookers at TV stations and at newspapers don't necessarily know that. And so they'll choose someone who's saying something interesting. And I guess that's the next piece. They want to have an argument. They it's in the media's interest to have people presenting extreme views. Ideally, people presenting opposite extreme views and having a fight with each other. So again, it's not in their interests to bring in the sort of deliberate, careful scientist who says, well, we don't know at this stage. This seems to make sense from past experience. So it's probably the best bet of something to do now. But we need to keep a watching brief and we need to be able to change down the road. And then there's the confirmation bias. You know, there's the people who don't want to believe something because a certain person from a certain political background has said it. Or who don't want to believe something because it doesn't fit into their existing worldview. And that becomes... That creates masses of noise and of polarization. And science is about reasoned and rational debate on the evidence. And when everyone's shouting, no one can hear the quiet conversation about the evidence. And, of course, everyone can shout now because we have these wonderfully democratizing technologies. Biggest democratization since the printing press, that means that anyone can get out there and be heard, right. Which is great, but it's not without risk.
Agreed. And I mean, like you said, confirmation bias and these things are prone, especially in a mass communication technology where everyone can share their opinions. There's sort of no barrier to entry, especially with maybe platforms like YouTube, TikTok, where, well, specifically TikTok, you can go viral in an instant sharing your opinion. And as long as you maybe you target a niche and confide in people who value and share your same judgment, it can become a sort of echo chamber, but then that can become a heuristic that guides you to make your medical decisions and maybe view whatever information comes at you with a certain set of ideas rather than openly taking in the information, maybe even critically thinking about it yourself and then going with it or speaking with your doctors, etc. And it's interesting because these kind of things can lead people to assume that maybe we've gone from vaccines to microchips or microchips in the vaccines and maybe don't take this one or this one because it'll actually sort of have these adverse effects or you'll be connected to this big cloud, etc. But speaking of microchips, there recently Neuralink, Elon Musk's company, it got approved by the FDA for in-human clinical trials. I'd be interested to hear your take on it. Sort of what do you think is the future of technology in medicine, maybe even more broadly AI in medicine, Neuralink specifically, from my understanding, it's going to initially involve clinical trials with maybe tetraplegic patients, people without the ability to move, people without limbs, etc. So I'd be interested to hear your take on maybe that specifically and what we can expect to see in that technology in the next coming 10 years. Will we become sort of AI interface in our day-to-day? Will it just be able to provide access for people to walk who maybe have had severe spinal cord injuries? Will AI more broadly revolutionize the medical industry, so to speak? And what's your take on that?
So I'll come to AI second. I guess the first thing is the implantable device, which is absolutely fascinating, and it's potentially immensely exciting. If we can use implantable devices to, in effect, bridge the connections where the connections have been broken in things like spinal injuries, So the signals from the brain go into one side of the implantable device, and the implantable device takes it across where the spinal cord has been cut and sends it in the nerves down to the arms, legs. I mean, that is amazing. That is an amazing way of helping heal harms that people might suffer in life. Mm-hmm. But there are more. There are far more applications of these implantable technologies. Mm-hmm. We're already seeing the sort of closed loop, continuous glucose monitoring, sort of artificial pancreas type systems, where you've got something that monitors the level of glucose in the body and automatically triggers the delivery of insulin. Into that person's body. And that's only just beginning. But this is all very new stuff. And we can see that in dozens of other diseases. Whether it's just to do the testing, whether it's having an ongoing sort of metric on a particular thing in your body that places you at risk. If you've got, I don't know, if you've got one of these genetic disorders where you have to avoid certain foods because they will build up and poison you, well, wouldn't it be great if you can actually detect those compounds or the metabolites, the things that those compounds are broken down into, if you could detect them early and actually say, well, do you know what? I've had too much of this thing in my diet today, too much phenylalanine, for example. There's a condition called phenylketonuria where you can't eat that. I've had too much today. I need to completely exclude it tomorrow. I need to specifically change my diet before the damage is done. Those sorts of things are potentially amazing and game-changing. And I think we will see more and more. We may well see, I've seen a few things that are around sensory organ replacements, which is, again, mind-blowing, bringing people back to a sense that they've lost, or even giving people. I've seen there was one piece, and this was about 10 years ago, where it was, in effect, creating sight for people who've never seen. Using existing senses. I've seen a couple, actually. There was one that was using echolocation. There was and then there was another that was using touch on the forehead, I seem to remember, to create a map of the environment. So there's all sorts of things like that. And some of them will work and some of them won't. But it's potentially immensely exciting going forward. AI is a mixed picture. Everyone's really excited about it. Yeah, everyone is hyping it right now and saying it's going to change the world. I guess what I would say is it might, but it's going to be a very, very long time before it does change the world in a positive way. It could create a disaster more quickly, but let's hope that doesn't happen. If you look in healthcare, I guess there are maybe half a dozen different use cases. Probably the best is imaging. So that's radiology analysis, but also pathology analysis as well, where AI can look at pictures and actually find things that humans miss. And I think we're probably getting there now. We're pretty close to having systems that are as good as, maybe even better than humans across the board. And we've certainly got systems that are really good at safety netting and at decision support. So identifying things to look at a bit further. And I think that's immensely exciting. There's a guy I had a couple of meetings with, really, really, really interesting guy. And he was doing some stuff around augmented reality, around AI in surgery. Where cameras will watch the operation, and if it looks like you're about to cut the wrong thing, a little voice will say, "Are you sure you want to cut that?" And that's I exaggerate slightly, but that's potentially immensely exciting, and it could mean that in an emergency, a less qualified person is able to do a procedure and save a life, when the more qualified person is in the big city 100 miles away and can't get there in time. You know, this sort of thing, that sort of use case is amazing. And that's all sort of image analysis and interpretation. So I think that's well on the road. I guess the second piece is about risk and risk prediction. Now, I'm not as sure about that. This is an area where I've worked before and where I work now. And I quite often get called in to look at risk prediction models that aren't working. And a lot of them are AI derived. And I can't think of one I've seen yet that is as good as the manually produced models my former team were producing 15 years ago. Using statistical techniques, there's one called multiple regression analysis. So doing lots and lots of big number crunching, but not machine learning, not AI in any meaningful sense of the word. Just lots and lots of data and analytics. And so I don't think that's there yet. I think people get very excited by it, and I'm sure people will make a lot of money selling products. But none of the ones I've seen yet, and I get called in by fairly big organizations to help troubleshoot the ones they're developing, none of them are as good as our manual one. So that's the second piece. Diagnostics is the third piece. That's really interesting. AI is better at diagnosing really, really rare disease than I am, than pretty much any doctor. But yeah, I won't use the expression I was going to use. But why is that surprising? You know, if there's something that I'm never going to see in 10 lifetimes, there's something that's that rare that a doctor is never going to see in 10 lifetimes, of course an AI that's around that, you know, that can look for that, can diagnose it better than I can. And certainly that use case is there for rare and ultra-rare disease. Diagnostically, AI is really good, and it's really useful as an additional tool. In common disease, it's interesting. My one of my very early research projects, way back when, was on decision support, clinical decision support, computerized clinical decision support. And one of the things we looked at was diagnostic systems that diagnose disease. And what we found going back there, which is like 30 years ago, 25 years ago, those systems that were rules-based, they were based on rules that had been identified and rules of thumb that had been learned from observing doctors' work, those systems were about as good at diagnosing disease as a pretty good medical student, but nowhere near as good as an experienced physician, nowhere near as good. And if you look at the general diagnostic AIs around at the moment, they're not much better. They're slightly better. They're probably as good as the bottom 10% of doctors. But I don't want the bottom 10% of doctors making diagnostic decisions about my family members. Right. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think there's a sort of blind belief that technology will sort it out. And so there's a signal to noise ratio thing. They throw more data in rather than cleaning the data. And there's potential for improving things that way. But I think that there's another piece that's around the human experience. When I walk into the room with a patient, or when I used to walk into the room with a patient, there are things that I'm picking up that I don't know I'm picking up. I am smelling things. I'm seeing things about the way that they move. I'm hearing things in the tone of their voice that I'm not registering consciously, but I'm registering them unconsciously. And those are all helping me in my decision making about what the diagnosis is for that person. Well, none of those things are being picked up by the current crop of diagnostic AIs. So why would they be as good as an experienced physician there in the room with the patient?
Right.
So that's diagnostics. I guess the next one, which is loads and loads of hype around, is drug discovery. And that's really exciting on one level. if we can identify molecules that potentially are going to be helpful in a condition, and we can also screen them for any harm they might do elsewhere in the body, that's big stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a problem. I was on a panel for the Canadian sort of embassy here a few months ago, and one of the other guys on the panel was an intellectual property lawyer, fascinating guy, and we were discussing this very issue, and he is strongly of the opinion that if AI is involved at any point in designing a molecule, a therapeutic molecule, a drug, it is not patentable.
Oh, wow.
Because the patent system is based on prior human art. Mm-hmm. And machine art is not human art, is my sort of my non-lawyer understanding of what he said. The problem is, it would be perfectly possible for the US to change the way its patent law operates. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
But it's not enough, because Canada has to do it as well, and Mexico has to do it as well, and the UK has to do it as well, and China has to do it as well. And realistically speaking, to get the World International Property Intellectual Property Organization, the WIPO, which is the global body that sorts this stuff out, to get that together to actually solve for AI assisted drug discovery is, in this guy's opinion, it's going to take at least 20 years. He may be wrong. I hope he's wrong. But that's big stuff. And I guess then the last bit is the generative AI. And this is what people think of. They think of Google Bard or ChatGPT, the thing that lets people fake their essays in college. I think there is potential there. I'm not saying anyone should do that, but these are the stories that we see in the media. I think there is potential there. Things like radiology reporting. So not only have you got the AI identifying what's wrong on this the X-ray of this person's chest, but also writing the report to the referring physician so that they get that. I think there's potentially a use case there. But there is a spurious. I think there are things where there are situations where there is what I call spurious validity. Mm-hmm. People believe things that a machine says more than they believe things that a non-expert person says. And that's one of the things that worries me about generative AI. Do you know, I asked one of the engines, I shan't say which, to write a biography for me the other day, about a month ago, basically because I needed to submit a biog for a project, and I couldn't be bothered to write one. So I thought I'd see if generative AI could help me. And it wrote me the most amazing biog that was extraordinarily flattering and very, very wrong. I mean, it had the wrong colleges. It had picked up other people's experiences and put them in to my biog. And for me, that was a real salutary tale, if you like. Mm-hmm. We need to be very, very careful about trusting these tools with something that's mission critical. I mean, I'm using them now. I have to say, if I'm writing a long piece, I will throw it at a generative AI to produce a skeleton that I will then throw into the document. And I'll probably end up throwing out everything that it's done, but it helped me find a structure. And it means I'm not working on a blank page because I like to edit more than I like to write. And I think that will grow more and more. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, and beyond the sort of radiology indication, I'm not convinced that generative AI can really make the difference. And I suspect what will happen is it will start getting put into electronic medical record systems and that sort of thing, and start churning out letters that will actually just be wrong or will not contain the salient information. And it will be you know, years down the line when we notice. Isn't an anecdote here, as we touch on electronic medical record systems, it's an anecdote here from my own life about 3 months ago. I was in the emergency room locally with a family member who was quite seriously ill. They had sepsis, you know, which is serious stuff. And it was all taking quite some time. They were, it's complicated. The specialist needed to come. There was the antibiotics that actually, it's a particular antibiotic that takes quite a long time to settle once you've mixed it. So you can't give it for about an hour or so. So I guess we were in the majors area, you know, where seriously ill people go, in the emergency room, emergency department, as we call it here, for about 2 or 3 hours. The whole time. And I watched the doctors, the equivalent of residents, the junior doctors, we call them. I watched them working between patients. Now, I've worked in that environment. I did about a year in emergency departments a long, long time ago. And it would take me between patients in the majors area, the more seriously ill area, it would take me maximum 5 or 6 minutes to write things down on the card, to fill in the form to order the tests and to read the test results and then staple them to the card. Mm-hmm. Maximum 10 minutes between patients. Mm-hmm. And I was watching these residents working on a well-known electronic medical record system, and they were spending 40 minutes between patients.
Wow.
They were struggling with the computer to get it to work. Now, I'm sure the computer's got all sort. The EMR system has got all sorts of checks and balances that are put in there to make care safe. But their productivity had gone down by 50, 60, 70, 80%. I mean, it was a massive reduction in productivity. So suddenly you need 2 or 3 times as many doctors to see the same number of patients. And that's all because someone had a good idea had the idea that computerized is better and paper is bad. Now, I'm not saying we should go back to scrawling on papyrus with an ostrich feather, but what we do need to do is we need to do proper real-world sort of cost-benefit analyses of technologies that are going to impinge on workflow, that mm-hmm. are going to impinge on healthcare before we introduce them at scale. But yeah, I'll climb off that high horse now.
Yeah, agreed. I'm very surprised because I know electronic medical records, that's a lot of healthcare workers, physicians, etc., they would most likely prefer to do less of it. And I know that a lot of people have templates when they're filling out patient notes, etc., for certain things. So I would assume it would be a lot easier to integrate maybe not a system like ChatGPT, but a specifically programmed language learning model within a medical system. But I'm very surprised to hear that kind of works to dismay. But luckily, we're kind of still in the early phases of it. But I'd like to touch on sort of wearables in health, and that seems to be like a much more mild version of these AI language models, detection models. There's a lot of hype, I would say, around Fitbit. Maybe it's died down a little bit, but maybe devices like Apple Watches that are able to have single lead EKGs, which seems to be pretty significant for a health monitoring device, or maybe like a little $400, $500, time telling device that you have. I would like to hear what's your thoughts on the future of that. Maybe even like there's toilets coming out that could potentially detect the nutritional content or assess the sort of matter that comes out and recommends certain nutrition profiles. Where do you think that's headed? And do you think that's going to be a big adoption relative to medicine and healthcare?
Look, I think it's an absolutely fascinating area. And I think there's lots and lots of potential there. And I'm wearing a Fitbit myself. I just happen to be wearing a watch as well because I like my watch. I think there's masses of opportunity there. I think that we need to be a little bit cautious because we only know what we know, and it's not necessarily bigger than that. So I'll give you an example. If something identifies an elevated heart rate in me, it doesn't necessarily know what I'm doing at that time and whether that's appropriate. It could be a disturbance of my heart's rhythm, which is really important and which needs treatment. It could be that I'm on my rowing machine, or I'm having an argument with a family member, or all sorts of other things, that might raise my heart rate. And so there is a piece there around interpretation. So if something triggers, if an elevated heart rate, and I'm using a very crass example, triggers something, it doesn't necessarily mean the same as it would in someone who arrives in the emergency room feeling short of breath, and lightheaded, and they have a heart rate of 150 beats per minute, and then they have an ECG, an EKG, and it shows an underlying problem. It doesn't necessarily give us that information. That doesn't mean it's not useful. It means we need to make sure that we understand that something that is measured in one place is not necessarily the same as the same measurement being done in a different context, and that's a what's the word? I think that's a learning curve. I have a good friend who is kind of director of an emergency department in England, and it's one of his pet hates, actually, is people who come in because their Apple Watch has told them to. I'm sure the same would be true for Fitbits as well. That's just what he said in the conversation. False positives are not without risk. They put strain on the system. They frighten the person who sees the false positive result. Et cetera, et cetera. So I think care needs to be taken. Now, there's some really, really exciting stuff out there. A friend of mine has got a wearable that his team has developed. It's basically a wearable that not only monitors your heart rhythm, but it can also potentially correct a certain abnormality in the heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation. And we don't know for definite yet. He's done a case series. I think it was about 20 or 30 people. And it looks really convincing. But what he's setting up to do now is a big, what's called a randomized control trial, which is the sort of gold standard way of testing whether something works or not. But it's amazing. It's potentially massive and very, very exciting. And I think that the wearable world will certainly go from strength to strength. I think there's some really, really interesting stuff out there. And then there's quite a few things which are a solution looking for a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely convinced that a toilet that can detect, my metabolites in my urine is going to be of much greater utility than a sort of urine dipstick that physicians have been using for, half a century more? And as a physician, you apply these tests when you think that there's a problem to look for. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. One of the tests on a urine dipstick is for ketones. Now, that can be really important in someone with diabetes whose diabetes is not well controlled. It can be associated with this complication called diabetic ketoacidosis, which is really, really dangerous. I mean, I know you know this, but just for the listeners, it's really dangerous. Now, on the other hand, if I haven't eaten anything much for a day or two, or if I'm doing a keto diet or a carnivore diet or something like that, and you dipstick my urine, it will show ketones. But there's no danger. There's no danger at all. It's just an indication of where my metabolism is. And because I don't have underlying diabetes and I don't have these other characteristics going on, it's not associated with risk. And there is a piece And I guess it goes back to what I was saying before. Things don't always mean the same thing. And so communicating that and getting that understanding out there is really, really important, because otherwise we're just going to have loads of people who are really, really scared because their toilet told them to be. And I'm not sure that's, you know, there's enough anxiety and depression out there in society already. There's enough trauma out there in society already. And I think we need to be really, really careful about unintended consequence on people's mental health and on their physical health. I'll give you another example. Some people go and have what I call a pan investigatorgram. Yeah, they're perfectly healthy, and they go and have a shed load of tests, loads and loads of tests, a whole body MRI, all of these things. And they find a tumor. Mm-hmm. Actually, most of us will find like four if we do a whole body MRI. But we've got no idea what that means. We don't know if it's going to turn into cancer or if it's nothing and will go away by itself. So what we do know is people are going to be much, much more anxious. Do you know, long story, I had a scan like maybe 10 years ago because I had a really weird rare condition. And so they were looking to see if it was caused by cancer. It wasn't. But they found a lesion. They found this lump just below my left knee. In the bone, they found this lump, and they got very, very excited, and they got very, very worried about, you know, what further tests they should do. I said, leave it alone. Do you know what? It's still there. I haven't died yet, not even once. It hasn't grown, and it was what I would call an incidentaloma. It was a growth of no clinical significance that just happened to be found. Now. That's okay for me. I can understand that. For someone else who is told, you've got a growth, you've got a tumor, that could be life-changing. It could be life-threatening, just the thought of it, when potentially there's no benefit at all. So I guess I know I'm saying the same thing in different ways. Caution, caution, caution. We need to be really, really careful. Yes, wearables and home appliances are potentially revolutionary. You know, the camera on your TV that can detect sleep apnea or detect a low oxygen in your blood, that could save lives and certainly improve quality of life. You know, the camera in the elder person's room that can detect if they've fallen down and can call a carer. Yeah, that can be massively beneficial, but we just need to be really, really careful about the risk of false positives.
So, yeah, it seems like from what you said, AI can potentially only assist in, it's not necessarily optimized for like an insight mechanism to really like understand and consider information from different perspectives. Like it'll tie in information that's not relevant to your background, for example, or it'll detect things that maybe don't necessarily have relevance to a certain thing. It seems similar to how social media can help overhype certain things and cause sort of mass hysteria. And then, for example, someone that sees on their Apple Watch that they may have an elevated heart rate, but basically the Apple Watch AI system software, it detects as you should go to the ER, their heart rate probably will elevate in a much more significant to a much more significant degree just because they saw that information. And then maybe they're actually now stressed, maybe they should be treated. But it is an interesting sort of concept. And that kind of reminds me of this other topic of psychedelics now and how it's being pioneered, reintroduced into our culture. And there's a lot of hype around it, how it could be this significant new treatment for mental health it can potentially provide a new way to conceptualize certain mental health disorders. I know that you have some work in psychedelics or at least have done some research in it. What's kind of your perspective on the general field of mental health and how a sort of compound class like psychedelics can play into it now that it's reemerging?
I think that there's a lot of opportunity to improve mental health care. Mm-hmm. Going forward. And I think psychedelics are going to be an important part, potentially, in some of that. Some years ago, I chaired the National Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Guidelines in England. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, one of the guys on my who was sitting on my committee was a professor of psychiatry who was chairing the depression guidelines in England. And one of the things he said to me really stuck. He said, I have no doubt that within my professional lifetime, psychedelic enhanced psychotherapy will be part of mainstream healthcare, mental healthcare. Wow. Because he had looked at the emerging evidence around, for example, psilocybin enhanced psychotherapy in depression, in multiple moderate depression and anxiety. He'd looked at the results around ketamine in severe depression and suicidality. We both looked at the results around MDMA in MDMA enhanced psychological therapy in post-traumatic stress disorder. And it is quite clear that these effect sizes are really powerful. There is potential there. And particularly you think about something like PTSD, where actually we don't really have any pharmacological treatments that are useful. You know, we've got two treatments that seem to work. There's trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy, and then there's a thing called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, I think is what it stands for. And they both work, but not much else really does. There's some evidence around meditation and mindfulness. Maybe certain medications can help a bit as an adjunct to the psychological therapies. But we don't have a game changer there, and we've got large groups of people who don't respond to treatment. Well, there's certainly the trials that have been done in the US and Canada around MDMA enhanced trauma focused CBT have been mind blowing. Excuse the unintended pun. They have transformed the lives of people with long term PTSD that has not responded to several different courses of treatment. And they've been pretty much, some of them have been pretty much cured. And that is breathtaking. I mean, to the extent that I believe that the Canadian equivalent of the Veterans Administration are now offering MDMA enhanced psychological therapies as part of their standard treatment pathway. I think there are problems with psychedelics. I think their mechanism of action is really, really interesting as well. The way I like to, I kind of have a musical analogy for it, if you like. I think a lot of mental health disorders are about being offbeat, being the wrong rhythm, if you like, in the way your brain pulses. And so it doesn't resonate right. And what the psychedelic drugs do is they interact with receptors that basically stop the rhythm completely, and it just becomes sort of random white noise. And it gives you a window of opportunity through a psychological therapy to establish a new rhythm into which the brain will settle. So it's like giving someone who's playing out of time a metronome so that they can play in time. And I think that's really exciting. Now there are problems with psychedelics in mental health. One of the problems is some of the people who are involved in the space. I think that enthusiasts don't always make the best science. And actually, what we need are the grown-ups in the room who will say, "We will test this in the way we would test any other treatment." And we will take it through that process and we will prove that it works. And then we will deploy it in the way we would deploy any other treatment. And in psychedelics, just as there was with cannabis-based medicines over the past few years, I think there are a lot of people who think they want to take a shortcut. They have an absolute belief that there is benefit. And so they don't have the patience to go through the process. And I think that's unhelpful. And I think it detracts from the efforts of those who do want to take a careful approach. I think the second piece is that it's pretty convincing. That's not certain. It's pretty convincing now. The psychedelics on their own probably aren't that good. They're not helpful at all. There needs to be the sort of psychotherapy, some sort of experience that will reset that metronome. That's looking pretty convincing in the evidence. And clearly there's lots of people who get very excited by the drug itself, not by a broader treatment that's actually difficult to deliver. And I guess that's the third piece. You know, if you're taking psilocybin, for example, a psilocybin-enhanced psychotherapy, you need to be in a really reasonably controlled environment that's quiet and calm, and then have this very intensive therapy once the psychedelic phase has passed. And we don't necessarily have the resources to deliver that. Mm-hmm. And also, it's just really difficult. It's really difficult to have something that is going to be in your body interfering with the way your brain works for 24 hours or 48 hours in the case of other of some psychedelics. So I think that's problematic because we're used to, you know, a little white pill that you take in the morning and you function through the day. Yeah. So I think there's some adaptation for services to engage in. But I also think that there's opportunity. I think there are some other psychedelics that are out there that have really short half-lives in the body. So mm-hmm. you could give it to a person and give them the therapy in your office. And by the time the session is over, they're fit mm-hmm. to drive home. Now, that makes it much more deliverable mm-hmm. in a sort of established way of working. But we're not there yet with the evidence. Mm-hmm. It's something I believe in. It's something I will certainly continue to be involved in working on. Mm-hmm. But we need to sort of quieten the hype and actually do the legwork. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting how even in this context, you say that the scientists or the people that tend to be the most excited to do this kind of research aren't always the best people to approach this. It's better to have the people who are more of the adults in the room to go ahead. And this is similar to that idea of people coming into the ER anxious because their Fitbit told them that they might be symptomic for some, I don't know, arrhythmia or maybe a heart attack. So it seems like one of the main points from this discussion is the overhype centered around many different areas, whether it's through social media, whether it's through different discoveries, or whether it's through different programs like an AI integrated in a system, or maybe like a personalized system that you could wear on your watch. It's very important to be cautious and sort of critically think before you incorporate these kind of concepts or devices into your routine or lifestyle more. And it's interesting how you emphasize that the psychotherapeutic component and understanding that is going to be at least the near future where the direction of understanding these compounds is headed versus maybe the classification or the development of these drugs. Maybe I've heard plenty of people that are working on maybe developing the drug where this hallucinogenic component is not as active relative to maybe some other components. I'm not sure on the efficacy of that. But I remember we've spoken about a while back how maybe the development of these drugs or developing these psychotherapeutic models is more effective in places like the UK or Canada relative to the US, potentially for some healthcare policy things, are just generally patent sort of the business aspect of doing business. I'd love to hear your sort of take on maybe, let's say, the UK/Canada healthcare system relative to the US and why researching these kind of compounds may be more effective in places like the UK.
So I think there's two things. I think there's researching them and then there's delivering them. And I think mm-hmm. in both of those cases, there is an advantage in Europe, particularly the UK, and also in Canada, maybe Australia as well, to a lesser degree. Mm-hmm. The first is about how the regulators do business. Basically, if I want to bring a new treatment to market in the UK, right now, I've just had the idea. I can approach the regulators here, and they will help me design the program that will optimize my chances of it becoming licensed and of it becoming reimbursed, so funded by the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. They'll actually help me along the way. And you know, there are specific programs around really exciting new medicines that where they do it even more. But even outside that space, they will help along the way. If I submit something for sort of ethical and regulator approval, they will come back to me and say, you need to change this, 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 and this, and then resubmit. And the same is true with Health Canada. They're very collaborative. If you're working with the FDA, it's much more difficult. With the FDA, it's much more you get it right and they accept it or they reject it. And then there's kind of, if they reject it, there's quite a lot of head scratching and sort of reworking of things. Now, those things can mean difficulties. They can mean cost. They can mean all sorts of things going forward. They can mean that the project never gets off the ground because you've put so much resource into your first attempt and you don't get anywhere. So I tend to bring I've tended to bring trials to the UK, and there's an additional reason why the UK is good. There's two additional reasons, really. One is that research out of the UK is recognized in pretty much every country of the world. If I research a drug here and get the evidence to bring it to market here, it will get market access almost everywhere. It won't in Japan, because Japan requires local trials. The US may want the later phase, the sort of final pre-market phase, to have some US involvement in it. So the FDA might want one of the centers in this sort of final pre-marketing trial to be in the US. But that's not a great hurdle. But everywhere else, it's very straightforward because they recognize the quality of the medical research. Now, I'm not going to name a country, but if it were in certain countries, you could do the trial, you could do it really cheaply, you could do it really easily, but no one's going to recognize the results. They're not going to trust the results. And so, you know, the UK is one of maybe, you know, five or so countries which are that well thought of internationally. The US is another. Second piece around the UK is that there's a big pharma industry here. There's a really big pharma industry here. So all of the vendors are there. All of the things that you'll need to help you with the trial are there. And there's a big university sector here. So all the academics and the principal investigators and key opinion leaders are here as well. So it's quite a good little contained space for running studies. You could, all of the same things could be said about the US as well. Mm-hmm. The difference being the regulator and the way the regulators interact. The second piece is around how healthcare is delivered. Mm-hmm. Now, where you've got single payer healthcare, like in the UK, where the treating physician is employed on a salary to do their job, then if there's a change, if there's a paradigm shift in the way care is to be delivered, they might not like it, because nobody likes change too much, but they'll do it. Yeah. The system will adapt and the new model will be delivered. So, for example, psychedelic enhanced psychotherapy could very quickly take root in the UK or in Canada or in mainland Europe because they all have these sort of single payer type systems with employed psychiatrists. In the US, the system is different. You know, a big part of people's earnings is based on their activity in private practice. Mm-hmm. Now, disrupting that model of service that they deliver, particularly with something that could cure the person or leave them disease-free for 5 years, is scary. Mm-hmm. And so there's much more inertia in the system towards adapting. And, you know, sort of case in point, probably the best psychological therapy in mild to moderate depression and anxiety is cognitive behavior therapy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, in Europe, it is the standard of care. In the US, it isn't. In the US, it is available to a much, much smaller scale, at a much smaller scale than in other Western countries. And the reason is there is inertia in the mental health system in the US towards change and towards adopting a new model of care. And this is, CBT has been around, what, 20 years? More? And it still hasn't taken root. And so my personal judgment is that the same would happen with psychedelics. So for me, the greenest pastures in psychedelics development are in Europe and I'm in the UK. I mean, I'm not saying that just because I live here and because of my accent. I really think that there is more opportunity here than in many markets.
It's interesting how you say that the standard of care in the US in the medical system, it seems to lean more towards maybe the acute treatment, and maybe even for something like a mental health condition or disorder, it would lean towards maybe a medication route versus a psychotherapeutic route right off the bat, potentially for maybe how the systems are incentivized, but also the access of care for a psychotherapeutic, maybe once a week or twice a week CBT is much more expensive than the US relative to like the standard of care in the UK, for example. It's interesting because it seems like in medicine in the US, this concept of professional scope creep, you may be familiar, where in a hospital, let's say in the US, you would have now, instead of 5 anesthesiologists in 5 surgical rooms, you can have 1 anesthesiologist managing maybe 5 CRNA, certified nurse or nurse anesthetics, or maybe even registered nurse assistants or something like that. And it seems like with new careers like nurse practitioners, physician assistants, etc., it seems like there is more of that leniency towards optimizing cost of care versus maybe quality or quality of care, potentially access of care could be more accessible in the sense. But that does seem to be a difference between US related medical systems versus maybe UK, Canada, etc. I'd love to hear your perspective on how maybe optimizing for cost could be relevant in the UK medical system and what your thoughts on maybe how the US is doing it.
Absolutely. But just before I do, I just want to go back for a moment to the previous question. Of course, sure. the other thing that drives standard of care in the US is that it's one of the only major market in the world with direct to consumer advertising. Mm-hmm. And so the patient asks for the pill, because the pill is advertised on TV, whereas the psychotherapeutic intervention is not advertised on TV. And so the patient doesn't come in with that expectation. And I think that influences care a great deal as well. And as I said, it's not replicated in other markets. On the sort of allied health professionals, as we call them in the UK, I think the trend is global. I think mm-hmm. the reasons are different from place to place. So you're absolutely right. In the US, it's about the most efficient use of assets, particularly if you're in an accountable care model where you're not necessarily earning on the basis of, you know, the activity by the most expensive person. Whereas what you want to do is get as many people treated as possible within a fixed cost envelope. And I think that is definitely a big driver there. I think it's also the physician associates is an interesting, or physician assistants. That's of course a different story, because the way they developed in the US was you couldn't recruit doctors into family medicine, because it was so poorly paid compared to specialist practice at the time, mm-hmm. and not seen as exciting at all. So PAs as a profession were developed in the US in mm-hmm. order to fill that gap and make sure it was possible to deliver services. And that's much more like the European model. So we are seeing a variety of other professionals, whether we call them nurse practitioners or advanced nurse practitioners or physician's associates, physician assistants, or all of these different professional groups, the extended scope pharmacist, all sorts of things like that. And they're about managing workload primarily. If you think about it, in just about every developed country in the world, we have, bar one that I can think of, we have an aging population. So our number of people who can deliver care is static or potentially, you know, longer term going to reduce, and the number of people who need care is increasing rapidly. So how do we maximize those assets, those dwindling assets, in order they can have much, much higher productivity? How do we make sure, how do I manage a caseload of 5,000 people when 10 years ago it might have been 1,500? And the way to manage that, the approach has been through sort of help of, in effect, supervised additional workers from other backgrounds. I think there are pros and cons. I think that sometimes the other professionals can be very algorithmic. They work to quite strict protocols, and that isn't always in the patient's best interests. And sometimes there is a risk of going down blind alleys and missing something important. But that happens with doctors as well. And I have no evidence to say that it happens more with these other professions than it does with doctors. All I know is that doctors I know complain about it when other professionals do it. I would love to see some proper research that actually says, you know, is there a difference in terms of the outcomes for patients? But yeah, I think that's the big driver here. My personal view is it's going to happen anyway, so find a way to embrace it. You know, it's like if you read there was a book about 15 years ago called The World is Flat that was about the sort of globalization. And one of the case studies in there was accountancy. And it was talking about how the model of delivering accountancy has shifted from actually looking at spreadsheets and totting things up and calculating it, you know, from your office in Chicago, to sending it to India for someone to do that. And you invite people to your office in Chicago and you shake their hand and you reassure them and offer them support. So it's a role shift because there's additional support to take away some of the workload. And I think that's how doctors should embrace this situation. So it's about being the final decision maker. It's about managing the relationship, the ongoing relationship with the patient. It's about keeping a broader surveillance role. It's about doing the difficult surgeries. And the things that actually most doctors are less excited by, you know, the really simple, straightforward surgeries, the routine sort of conversations and engagement, leaving those to others who can cope with those. So my personal view is be excited by change. Embrace it because it is going to happen anyway. I don't see how health services can be delivered 30 years from now if we're relying on doctors to deliver them without bringing in other professionals, because we can't grow lots more doctors if for no other reason than doctoring is not easy. Not everyone can do it. if that makes sense. And getting to be a doctor is really, really quite onerous for people. We already have fairly high attrition rates, you know, mm-hmm. from medical, from pre-med through med school, through internships and residency. At every step, we lose people to the profession. If we increase intakes, that will only get worse, and we won't actually end up with significantly greater numbers.
Yeah, I think that point about how now we're seeing this attrition rate kind of go up across the entire, like, sort of medical pathway from being a maybe high school pre-medical student all the way up until your final days of residency, fellowship, and maybe even into your early years as either an attending in the US or the relative term in the UK. I think it's very interesting, the point of how being a doctor is still onerous work, how the advent of AI and the advent of these sort of lower barrier to entry healthcare careers, like being a nurse practitioner or working in a related field that maybe a doctor would have occupied prior, it's not necessarily that should discourage someone to pursue a career as, for example, a medical doctor. It's just that the scope of practice will be slightly different, but it's still an onerous work, and that's something to be proud of. So it's better to adapt to the changes rather than sort of see it as this kind of negative thing. And I think it's interesting how now we're seeing all of these new medical advancements, like sonification procedures from coming out from Northwestern, where they were able to sort of shut down the blood-brain barrier in certain region to deliver chemotherapy for glioblastoma. Or recently out of Stanford came out a procedure where surgeons were able to transplant a beating heart from a donor patient into a patient who needed the transplant. And with all of these new advancements, we've spoken about AI, all these different technologies, different medical devices, potential new psychotherapeutic models for treatment, mental health conditions. What aspects of medicine are you sort of hopeful for? And then what things would you say we should address maybe in the next 5 to 10 years is kind of an early progression, but maybe in the next 10, 20 years in order to prepare ourselves for maybe the advent of more AI in medicine, maybe more outsourced procedures to people with lower barrier of entry for education to perform certain procedures. Where do you see the future of medicine, and how would you sort of frame that?
So I guess the first thing I'll say is I'm excited by all of it. I think it's all potentially amazing, but it's also all potentially nothing. You know, sometimes people accuse doctors and the healthcare system of being barriers to progress, mm-hmm. but it's the opposite of the truth. We strive to innovate every single day. We strive to bring in new treatments. We just want to make sure that we know that they work and they don't do any harm. First, I think the blood-brain barrier piece is really interesting. It's partly because I have an interest in glioblastoma. I know various people who have lost loved ones to GBM, and I've actually run trials in that disease myself. And it is a horrible illness. I've now seen two or three different technologies that have effect on the blood-brain barrier that allow drugs that wouldn't normally cross. So the sonification is one. A second one is potentially Ritalin. Ritalin changes the blood-brain barrier and allows things to cross that otherwise wouldn't. And one school of thought is it's actually these sort of micro neurotransmitters from the gut that are managing people's ADHD in Ritalin. It's nothing to do with the effect of Ritalin on dopamine. It's the effect of Ritalin on opening up the blood-brain barrier is one potential hypothesis I'd love to see people researching. And I work with a group who have been doing some work with I don't know what you call it, drug delivery technologies. So using lipid, using solid solutions of drugs in fat that makes them cross the blood-brain barrier when otherwise they wouldn't. And they're also working in the glioblastoma space. I'm particularly excited by that because there are implications across a whole variety of diseases. So there are two terms in pharmacology. There's pharmacokinetics, which is kind of how the blood, how the drug comes into the body and then out of it again. And there's pharmacodynamics, which is how it moves around the body. Now, up until this point, we have done nothing particularly useful around pharmacodynamics. We've not been able to influence it. We've been able to influence things getting in and staying in or going out more quickly. We haven't been able to force drugs, if you like, to go to the brain, to go to inflammatory cells. Well, some of these technologies are doing that. And that is really, really exciting, because then you end up with a higher concentration in the target organ and a lower concentration elsewhere. So side effects suddenly become less of a problem and the drug becomes more effective as well. And I think that for me is a really, really exciting area. The second one I would pick is, and I would have picked this, I'm just going to say I would have picked this 3 years ago, 4 years ago as well. So this is not just hindsight. mRNA technology in vaccines. I think that is a massive game changer. That is so exciting because it means the lead time for a vaccine is potentially 100 days and not 2 years. Potentially even 30 days going forward. There's a research project here that I'm an old school friend of mine's husband happens to be involved with, which is getting the lead time down to 30 days, which is, you know, is game changing in terms of infectious disease, but also in terms of other disease. Cancer vaccines suddenly are much, much quicker and cheaper to develop. And we're going to see that, you know, increasingly over the next 5 to 10 years. I guess the last thing I would say is five to 10 years is already here. We horizon scan on that time scale all the time. And actually a lot of treating physicians as well as regulators and payers are that far sort of upstream in the pipeline already and know what's coming. As to what will actually change the world, who knows? I suspect that the major impact of AI will not be in the next decade. I think it will have some positive impacts, but it's not going to be a game changer for a while. I think mRNA technology will. I think that's going to drive massive change. And microbiome. We touched on it earlier. I think as knowledge grows about the microbiome, then the potential for harnessing that in disease management will become more and more and more powerful. And that's where I would, I guess if I had to choose one thing, that's the thing I'd choose. Because I was brought up to believe you are what you eat, and maybe we can... change people's lives by changing how they eat as well.
Wow, that's very inspirational. That's a sort of a good note to end this conversation on. But I would also like to see what would be, if you could go back to maybe your early pre-medical days in college or university, what kind of advice would you tell yourself now if you were pursuing the same sort of passions? I know earlier you said you kind of went on to graduate school because you wanted to stay in the system, and that was kind of your way of doing it. And justifying to your parents, what would you say to a student right now, maybe finishing up their undergraduate days, maybe even in high school, and they're inspired by this conversation, they're interested in maybe harnessing the power of AI, figuring out, finding interest in mRNA vaccines, the microbiome, maybe a lot of different topics. What would you say to your younger self if you had to do it all over again today?
So I guess the first thing I would say is, and I'd say it to my younger self and I'd say it to anyone else, don't fixate on one thing. Don't fixate on a single goal. There are 1,000 different careers in medicine. And 10, 15, 20 years from now, there'll be 1,000 different ones. And they're all exciting. Go through your life with an open mind and take the opportunities when they arise. You know, I started out, I was only interested in pediatric oncology. That's what I was going to do. No thought of doing anything else. And on my road towards that, I was offered accelerated opportunities in radiology and in ear, nose and throat surgery. And I pushed them away. I said, no, this is what I want to do. But then it turned out that for complicated reasons, there was never going to be an opportunity for me going forward because all of the roles would have been filled and I'd have to wait. So I ended up doing something else. I ended up changing direction. Do you know what? I could have said, I've been offered this thing in radiology. That's really, really exciting. Think of what I could do with that and taken it. So keep your peripheral vision going, I guess is what I would say to someone. Be aware of any opportunity that's going. And in terms of awareness, read. Mm-hmm. Read. But choose the sources you read. Make sure you're reading what's in high quality medical journals or high quality sort of magazine publications. You know, the New Scientists and the equivalent. Listen to high quality podcasts. Watch high quality documentaries, and just get that breath because it's so much fun. I think one of the things I think we've lost in modern times is a sense of awe. You know, awe used to be really important in the sort of medieval world. You know, and that's why cathedrals were built the way they were. So people would walk in and they would be filled with awe at this amazing building. And I'm a great believer in it. I think it's a really, really positive energy in life. So find ways to find awe in life. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to concur with that. I think awe-provoking experiences and sort of trying to find that within whatever context you're currently in and seeing what next step you could take, that will probably be the most fulfilling step you could do. And like Dr. Hadjioff has mentioned, AI, it's infancy yet, but it's only going to have an exponential curve. And finding how to maybe integrate that in new technologies or sort of just having that I'll provoke you to find those opportunities in whatever it is you want to pursue and being able to take that shift as you sort of go along to find those opportunities. I think like Dr. Hadjioff said, you'll be well prepared to take on the future endeavors. But with that said, Dr. Hadjioff, it's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Where can people maybe reach out to you or find maybe your socials? I know you have a LinkedIn platform if they'd want to connect or stay sort of in the update of what kind of work you're onto.
So firstly, thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure talking with you. You've asked me some great questions. It's been fun discussing them. In terms of keeping in touch with me, LinkedIn is probably the best platform. I share things that I find that are of interest quite regularly on LinkedIn and on Twitter, but I look at LinkedIn a lot more. Because it's work, if that makes sense. It's a professional network. So just find me on there. Dr. Steve Hadjioff is how I'm identified there. And please do. I'm always interested to meet new people and have new conversations. So look me up there and reach out.
Okay, awesome. We'll definitely put the link in the description. And once again, it's been a pleasure. Take care, guys. Thank you for listening.